This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Journalist Hedrick Smith first covered the Soviet Union when it was considered America's most feared enemy. He won the Pulitzer Prize for his reporting from Moscow for the New York Times, where he was the bureau chief from 1971 to 1974. And his book, The Russians, was an international bestseller. 2 years ago, Smith began returning to the Soviet Union to see the new society shaped by Mikhail Gorbachev's policies of glasnost and perestroika. He has a new book about the revolutionary changes called The New Russians. Earlier this year, Smith hosted a four-part series for PBS called Inside Gorbachev's USSR. A year ago, it seemed that peace was breaking out around the world with the victories of pro-democracy movements throughout Eastern Europe. But recent events in the Gulf have created unexpected pressures for Gorbachev's new foreign policy.
It obviously has been a difficult situation for Gorbachev and the new Russian leadership in Moscow, because what they really want is a peaceful world. Perestroika is all based on a long-term strategy of getting along with the rest of the world and not having problems, particularly with the West, because they need Western credits and Western technology and basically a quiet situation in the world so they can devote themselves to their internal affairs. So Saddam Hussein has not only thrown a curve at us, but he's thrown a curve at Gorbachev, and Gorbachev has obviously had a lot of difficulty dealing with it. The decision to go with the West, to go with George Bush on the United Nations sanctions at first was one that they made very quickly. It fitted in with Gorbachev's new thinking. Obviously, Gorbachev and Shevardnadze, the foreign minister, have been more resistant to the idea of using force. But even on that now, they've come around, which is an indication of how much the new thinking has taken hold in Soviet foreign policy and how the pressing needs of modernizing that economy override the traditional politics of the Cold War, even in the Third World.
Iraq had been an ally of the Soviet Union. What was the basis of that relationship?
Well, fundamentally, it was a way of challenging the West. The Russian leadership, going back to the czars as well as the communists, has always been inclined to push to the south towards the warm water ports, the landmass of Russia being so northerly and landlocked and cold. The outlet through Leningrad, through the Baltic Sea, is sometimes difficult in the wintertime. There's a tendency to push towards the south, towards oil. And Iraq was a great, huge country, which brought them very close to the Persian Gulf. That is, the Russians put them on the Persian Gulf, as it were. So they helped build the Iraqi army. They equipped the Iraqi army. They backed the Iraqis. Of course, they've been on the Arab side of the Arab-Israeli dispute. The Russians have for a long time. So all this fit very well with Moscow's global politics.
It's more than the Gulf crisis that's eclipsed last year's victories, last year's sense of peace breaking out around the world. There are immense problems in the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe now, problems that have to be faced after the euphoria of the events of a year ago. In the Soviet Union, they're facing a terrible food shortage, although I guess it's unclear whether it's a food shortage or more of a distribution problem.
There's no question it's a huge distribution problem. What we're seeing, Terry, is the breakdown of the Soviet economic system. It was something, I think, that had to happen. I think that a lot of Western observers have sort of looked at the functioning of the Soviet economy, our American economic experts on the Soviet economy, and said, look, it's all breaking down. It's not working. There's going to be a calamity. There's going to be a collapse. It's chaos and so forth. What a terrible thing. Gorbachev's going to get thrown out and so forth. Some of that may happen. But if you were going to move from a highly structured state system run by Gosplan, the state planning agency, in which orders were given to every factory on how much it would produce, where it would get its raw materials, what it would charge for its output, in fact, exactly what it would produce, and you're going to shift away towards a market economy, it seems to me almost inevitable that you are going to go through a period such as the one the Soviets are now going through. It's painful. It is chaotic. It's got some political dangers in it. But economically speaking, it seems to me it was somewhat predictable. And oddly, the very process of reform may be going on while the leaders debate at the top, while Gorbachev and Boris Yeltsin, the renegade Moscow party chief, former Moscow party chief, are arguing about market reform. In fact, it may be occurring at the grassroots level. If you can't get the state system to force the and to order the state farms and the collective farms, these huge farms they have all around the country, to harvest their grain and their potatoes and their cabbages and grow their raise their meat and poultry and so forth and ship it into the cities by state orders. Then what starts to happen is when the shelves of the state stores in the cities of Moscow and Leningrad and Sverdlovsk and Volgograd and so on are empty, people start adjusting to a new economic system on their own. They start going to buy in the farmers' markets where farmers can grow some of their own goods on their own private vegetable plots next to their homes. Or the city of Moscow, the new reform government in the city of Moscow, which was elected last spring, or in Leningrad or some of these other cities, they begin making their own deals with the state and collective farms, and the stuff gets transferred directly. Russians and other Soviet nationalities have been doing this for decades under the Soviet system illegally. And what's going on now is it's becoming, if not officially sanctioned as national policy, at least tolerated by the authorities, because that's the only way, particularly with food, that you can get the stuff there.
Gorbachev declined to pick up his Nobel Peace Prize recently because things were so bad at home. He felt he couldn't take another trip out of the country. And then he went before people and he declared himself guilty before the working class, guilty in part for the food shortages. Do you think Gorbachev is taking the rap when it's a problem that couldn't be avoided? Or do you think that he is responsible for problems that, that the Soviets are facing now, like the food shortages?
Both. I think that some of this couldn't be avoided. It was going to happen, and whoever's watch it would happen on would be unpopular and would be criticized. Boris Yeltsin, who is a very charismatic, dynamic, populist leader who got 5 million votes in Moscow in the city elections of 89, got another million votes in the city elections of Sverdlovsk in 1990, would be in trouble himself if he were actually in charge, responsible for the policies. But I do think it's also true that Gorbachev has made some very big mistakes. He moved on economic reform late. He did not begin in 1985 and 86 at the very start with liberalizing reforms. He did not take the plunge as Solidarity has taken in Poland. And by the way, let's look at the Poland, the vote in Poland recently. Mazowiecki, the prime minister, was not exactly popular in that recent election, and one reason is he's taken the rap for what they did. But at least Solidarity decided that at the moment when they came into office, able to blame the communist leadership of Poland for the problems and enjoying the greatest popularity in their own country that they were ever going to get, that was the moment to take the political risk of swallowing the bitter medicine of unemployment and higher prices and the dislocation of moving to a market economy. Gorbachev, on the other hand, at his moment of maximum popularity in 85 and 86, when he could blame Brezhnev and Stalin and his predecessors, did not take the plunge. So that was a major mistake on his part. So now when there's no food in the stores or not enough food, people are angry at him both because he's the incumbent and the reformers are angry at him because he won't bite the bullet.
Gorbachev was just given more authoritarian powers by the Soviet legislature to give him the clout to try to stop the food shortages. Is this a step in the opposite direction of democracy?
Yeah, it is. It's a danger that, in fact, Gorbachev will become an agent of the right wing. Many people worry about whether or not the right wing in the army and the KGB and the Communist Party will throw him out. Gorbachev is moving over to the right now. He is preempting the right. He has himself in some ways become much more the right wing. He's at least a man in the center. He's certainly not on the left in the most progressive part, and he's moved to the right. It is a danger that he's going to move in that direction. But part of the problem is that authority is broken down in that system, and nobody can be a new Stalin again. Gorbachev has gotten more formal powers than certainly he had at the beginning and probably than some of his predecessors had. But formal power won't make it in that country. You have to have also moral authority. At the same time he's been getting more power, his popularity has been falling. And he can't get Boris Yeltsin in the Russian Republic or Landsbergis and Prunskina in the Lithuanian Republic or the new leaders in the Ukraine and some of the people in Central Asia to do what he wants, even though he's got the power theoretically to force them to do it, because he's opened the way to a much more disputatious, pluralistic system in which these people are now saying, darn it, we want to run our own affairs. You want to share power with us? We'll share it. If you don't want to share power with us, at a minimum, we won't do what you want us to do. So what you have is a kind of a paralysis of power, a stalemate.
Why do you think, as the country has moved more toward democracy, that Gorbachev has moved more toward the right?
Well, I think for two reasons or three reasons. Number one, the situation is chaotic. And for a system which was based on order and for a people who are used to order for centuries, not just the last 70 years of communism, but going back to Ivan the Terrible, you know, in the 14th and 15th century before America was ever discovered, for people like that to see the kind of disintegration of the economy and the disintegration of the nation and the retreat from Afghanistan and the retreat from Eastern Europe and to see Armenians in a bloody war against Azerbaijanis and having to send 25,000 Soviet troops into that area, that's scary. They're worried that's going to happen in their city or their province. And so there's a tendency of Russians in that kind of situation to say, hey, we need a krepki kulak. We need a strong hand. We need a new Stalin. So that's number one. That's a kind of a basic instinct of the people to which Gorbachev is responding. And also crime is on the rise. There are a lot of other problems that are going on. So a tough hand, a kind of a law and order sentiment. Secondly, Gorbachev is a man now who's 59 years old. He's been a reformer because he grew up at the critical time in his youth under Khrushchev. And Khrushchev was a reformer. Gorbachev was in university at that time. He was impressionable. That was a very formative period of his life, not only his life but that of his generation. And so they caught the bug of reform, which they then began to implement in the middle 80s. But they're also that generation, people now roughly 60 years old. They're also people of the old system. And so they have a hard time going too far. Gorbachev may have reached his limits, and he's constantly being pushed by radicals, by younger people, by more radical people like Boris Yeltsin, to go further. And there's part of his own psyche that is torn between the need for reform, the desire to make things better, and we got to save what we got. We've gone too far. Then thirdly, there is what you were talking about before. There is a right wing. The whole army is not right wing. It's as divided as the rest of the society. But there is a right wing in the party. There's a right wing in the army. There's a right wing in the Interior Ministry, in the KGB, the security services, if you will, which are also pushing him in the opposite direction as the radical reformers. And they're saying, hey, Misha, you've gone too far. You've ruined everything. You got to get tough. So he's feeling political pressures, not only from the man in the street, but he's feeling political pressures within the system. So what do you see? You see Gorbachev zigzagging. He goes for a while on reform, and he zigzags back, and he goes back to the right wing.
You've coined a new phrase to help describe some of what's going on in the Soviet Union now, and I'm thinking of the culture of envy.
You know, we tend to look at politics in any system as a battle of people in the leadership, the arguments that people have over what should be the right policy, the right ideology. In the case of perestroika and reform in the Soviet Union, we look at it in terms of Gorbachev's battle with the hardliners in the party, the bureaucracy, 18 million strong, he says, that wants to hang on to its seats of power. But what we often don't do, I think, Terry, is understand the culture and the mindset of very ordinary people, which is often the most difficult thing to change. Perestroika, I think I said a few minutes ago, is not just a matter of new institutions, beginning elections in a country which hasn't had real elections for 70 years, freeing up the press, moving towards a market economy. It is about changing this mindset of people. And when I talk about the culture of envy, what I'm talking about is something that I've encountered among the Russians as I've traveled around that country, 40,000 miles in the last couple of years on 9 different trips. And also, I've heard about from Russian reformers who are frustrated by not being able to do more. And what they'll say is, our people are jealous, our ordinary people are jealous of other people getting ahead. Being a winner is a good thing in America, and being a loser is not so good. But being a winner in the Soviet Union is not always very popular with a lot of people. I've been on farms, state farms, where I've heard about cases where farmers tried to expand their private plot and to grow more food and to try to sell it in the market, that while they tried to raise more livestock and expand their small herd of sheep or cattle. And other farmers have let the livestock at night. They've snuck in and they've let the livestock out of the barn, or they burned the barn, or they've destroyed the crops of these people. There's a jealousy and an envy even on the farm. You also run into it in the cities where you've got now about 5 million private entrepreneurs or people in the private sector working, running mom-and-pop grocery stores or restaurants or cleaners or watch repair shops, and some people even running textile factories and brick factories and building roads and that kind of stuff. You find in the cities that workers and other people will smash the windows of these restaurants or will write dirty slogans all over them or destroy some of the plants that people are setting up. And the new entrepreneurs have to pay protection money. Part of that is a distaste for capitalism. Part of it is a fear of the market. Part of it is real jealousy at seeing other people get ahead. I had a story told to me, not once, but at least a half a dozen times by different Russians, which illustrates this. And I was asking these different people what it was that made it so difficult to change the motivation of ordinary people. And the mayor of Leningrad, Anatoly Sobchak, told me this story. And as I say, I heard it again in other places. He said, there's a story we have about Ivan, a Russian peasant, in the countryside. And God comes to Ivan one day and says to him, Vanya, you're a good peasant, you work hard in the fields and so forth, but you have a tough life. I'm going to give you one wish. You can wish for anything you want in the world. And Vanya is overwhelmed. He's never had this kind of an opportunity before, and he starts dreaming about what he'd like to have. And as he's thinking, he's about to answer God, and God says back to him, according to this story, Vanya, you must remember that whatever it is I give you, I'm going to give twice as much to Volodya, your neighbor, down the road. Well, this drives Ivan crazy. He can't stand the thought of Volodya having that much more than he's going to have. And he doesn't know what to answer to God. And then finally, according to this story, he turns to God and he says, to the sky, I guess, and says to God, God, please take out one of my eyes and take out two of Volodya's eyes. In other words, double my misery to make him worse off. Now, that's a terrible story when you stop to think about it, for anybody to tell about his country and his countrymen. As I say, I heard that again and again. There are other stories that strike the same theme. I won't take long to tell you them. But that is something that is very important. It goes along with the very lax work ethic that a lot of Russians have on factories and in the farms and in the institutes and so forth, that the saying goes among Russian workers, they, meaning the bosses, they pretend to pay us, and we pretend to work. They pretend to pay us, and we pretend to work. In other words, nobody's really pushing it too hard. Russians are capable of working hard. And this is not a failing of theirs if they've got a motivation, they got an incentive if they're working for themselves. But they've had decades of communism, and indeed decades before that, even after the end of serfdom under the czars, in which they did everything communally, in which they shared things. And unless there was great motivation and great spirit in their community, there was a tendency to do just enough but not really to excel. That's an enormous drag on anybody who wants to create reform. To change that mentality, to change that mindset, and to generate a new motivation that people will believe in and work for. That's tough.
Journalist Hedrick Smith is my guest, and he's the author of the best-selling book, The Russians, and a new book called The New Russians that's based on his travels through the Soviet Union between 1988 and 1990. The Soviet military has just been given permission to use force in the republics to defend military installations, monuments, and to defend the military. What's the significance of that?
Well, the significance is that the situation has deteriorated so badly that people are pulling down monuments to Lenin, monuments to Soviet patriotism and World War II. You find in the Baltic republics, we were talking about just a few minutes ago, that people literally would go stand toe-to-toe with the Soviet Red Army and say, get out, we don't want you here, you're occupiers. You came here during World War II, and you're not here by our permission and by our will. We want you to leave. And even in Latvia, one of the city governments, city areas of responsibility around the capital of Riga, literally passed a local council, passed a local ordinance saying that they were going to cut off the food and water and electricity supplies for Soviet army bases in that region of Latvia unless the Soviet troops got out. That's what that was directly in response to, that episode. But what that shows is the degree of tension that has now developed over these nationality issues, over the issues of independence. What's going on, particularly in the Baltics, is that those people are smart enough to realize that they cannot fight the Soviet army. They cannot fight the Russians. There are something like 10 or 11 or 12 million people who live in these Baltic republics. There are 150 million Russians. The Russians have got the artillery, the tanks, the aircraft, the nuclear weapons. So it's not an even fight. So what's going on is that these people in the Baltics are trying to break away, but do it through peaceful protest. In a way, it's similar to Martin Luther King leading the civil rights movement in this country. Nonviolence, civil disobedience, putting the pressure on the central authority without getting into a fight. And then if there's a fight, you throw your hands up and say, fine, throw me in jail. But just understand I'm protesting, and I want the world to notice that this is immoral, illegal, and against my will. And indeed, it's also against the Soviet Constitution, because the Soviet Constitution gives Soviet republics the right to secede. Many people compare the situation improperly between Soviet republics and American states. No American state has it written into the Constitution that it has the right to secede. It is written into the Soviet Constitution, and indeed has been for the last 70 years, that Soviet republics have the right to secede. Now that they want to exercise that right, Gorbachev and the others are throwing up all kinds of obstacles. They want to pass new laws. They want to set new requirements. They want to prevent that from happening. I think in the end they can't resist it, that the will of these people is that strong, and they simply will not collaborate. They won't cooperate with the Soviet leadership unless they got the right to go their own way, settle their own destiny.
Given the food shortages, other economic problems, republics trying to secede, do you still think of what's happened in the Soviet Union as the most extraordinary peaceful revolution of the 20th century?
So far, yes. I mean, if we find that that hundreds of thousands of people die, then obviously that's something I'm going to have to readjust. But at the moment, over the last 5.5, now nearly 6 years since Gorbachev took power, something like 1,000 people have been killed in what you could call political violence. But 1,000 people, terrible as it is, in a society that large, going through as sweeping a change as that one is not really very astonishing. In the same period in the country of Ceylon or in India, several thousand people have died. So ethnic violence is unfortunately a sad fact that exists around the world. The other thing that is important to notice about the violence is that it has taken place basically on the fringes of the Soviet Union, in Central Asia, in the Caucasus, not in the Baltic states, but a bit in Moldavia, in areas a long ways away from the central cities, from Moscow, from Leningrad, from the big Russian cities. Regimes fall and get overthrown in revolutions when there's mass violence in the central cities. They don't get overthrown when there's violence on the periphery. So far, that's an important distinction that Gorbachev and the Russians have been able to maintain. The real test is now going to be, are you going to get food riots and violent suppression in the central Russian cities? If that happens, then my estimate changes, and that will be a great tragedy.
Well, Hedrick Smith, I want to thank you very much for talking with us about the Soviet Union.
It's a great pleasure. It's a fascinating topic, and it's very interesting to talk with you.
Thanks for being here. And Hedrick Smith has a new book about the Soviet Union called The New Russians.